But you can screw any other crew member you like on your own time, as long as you don't disrupt ship's duties or its general calm. I'm not exactly in the mood. It'll be 2 weeks to Bremen. You may change your mind. In any event, there's your tablet and there's your letter. And now you know where you are and why. Do you have any other questions at the moment? Not for you, Kiva said. Then you're dismissed. Either Chuckle or Fuckle, as you call them, will escort you back to your quarters. And, Lady Kiva, if I may make a suggestion. What is it? You may have noticed I was tolerant of your threats and attitude in our little chat today, Robinette said. That's because I find it strangely charming and because I know that being in a hole for 4 days would make anyone testy. I don't suggest you continue with that attitude with me from here on out, and especially not in front of my crew. The Hourlove may be a shithole, as you describe it, but it's a shithole that needs tight discipline, and I can't and won't tolerate anything that messes with that. Do we understand each other? Fine. Good. Also, I strongly suggest not trying that attitude with the crew, either. Why? Because it would be mean? No. Because they'll break a butter knife off in your neck. I thought you said you kept tight fucking discipline on this ship. I said the ship needs tight discipline. I didn't say that if you tested that proposition, you wouldn't find yourself dead. Nadashe's letter was, of course, irritating as all fuck. It went like this. Kiva, because I know you are wondering, here is why I've kept you alive. One, because it amuses me to keep you alive on that terrible ship. Two, because I'll need you alive to access some of those still frozen accounts. Three, because keeping you alive will keep your mother and the House of Lagos in check. There's something to be said for the fine art of keeping hostages. I should note that the last of these is something I'm keeping in my pocket for now. As far as anyone else knows, you were killed along with Drusen Wolf. After my contractor killed Wolf and stunned you, my own ambulance crew was first to the scene and ferried you away. I regret to say you died on the way to the hospital, and your body immediately shipped in a closed casket back to Ikoyi. I framed Wolf for it. He was killed by his own sloppy contractors. Good help is hard to find. Oh, you snide fucking piece of shit, Kiva said out loud as she read that last bit. You really think you're being clever? I've kept you alive for now, but I obviously can't have you at end. So, now you're on your way to Bremen. I believe you know what I have planned. I have reason to believe it will happen soon. If I am successful, then it's possible I will recall you to retrieve my property and to discuss with you, as your family's lead negotiator, the disposition of the House of Lagos in the new regime. After all, you were so considerate with the House of Nohamapeton while you were privileged to look after its interests. I look forward to having a Nohamapeton return the favor. If I'm not successful, then I regret to say that I will likely not be in a position to send further instructions to Captain Robinette and his crew with respect to your disposition. By this time, I'm sure the captain has told you what that will mean. And before you suggest to him that my failure means that he won't get paid the remainder of what's owed to him, you should know that he knows that the remainder is already in an escrow account back at Hubfall. Sorry to disappoint you on that. I'm afraid there's not much more to say, other than that you should wish me luck. Your life depends on my success. Enjoy Oktoberfest. N.N. Kiva read the letter, read it again, read it one more time just to be sure, then tore it up into small pieces, went to the crew head down the passageway from her broom closet, tossed the torn up bits of letter into the head, pulled down her pants, sat on the head, and pissed all over them. This action did not change the overall tenor of Kiva's current circumstances, but it did make her feel better. Having done that, Kiva returned to her broom closet and considered her situation and what advantages and assets she had at the moment. Advantages. She was fucking alive, which honestly had come as something of a surprise to her after being shot in the face. The captain was correct that she didn't look very pretty at the moment. Her face was a mass of subdermal bruises and pockmarks where the drug-laden bits of powdery shot had gone into her skin to be absorbed. But that wasn't anything she was worried about. It wasn't going to slow her down any. Assets. Her brain. Her body. Not her face, per se. See above, ray, bruises, and pox. But everything else, inside and out, was working on all cylinders. Plus, her current state of being, which was fucking pissed. Not just fucking pissed at Nadashi Nohama Peten, to be clear, although Kiva was indeed righteously fucking pissed at her. Nadashi had had her shot in the face, kidnapped, and put into space on a ship that was basically a case of fucking lockjaw waiting to happen. Nadashi needed to get an attitude adjustment, and Kiva very much wanted to be the one who gave it to her. But the person Kiva was most fucking pissed at was herself. Senia had been right. Nadashi had found Kiva where she wasn't looking. Kiva had walked into that meeting with Drusen Wolf confident that she had the upper hand, that Wolf and Nadashi were going to fall for her plan exactly as she had intended. She had been overconfident and underprepared, and it ended up with her being shot in the face and with her fate in the hands of a fucking Nohama Peten. Kiva paused briefly to think about Senia, who almost certainly thought that Kiva was dead and who was having to deal with that. Kiva felt something stab at her, something that she was not entirely sure she'd ever felt before. Grief, but not for the dead, which would be her and she was not, but for the living, who had to sit with their own grief for the dead. It wasn't fair to Senia to have to deal with this grief, and while Kiva was never one to delude herself that the world was anything close to approaching fair, this felt like a special flavor of out of bounds, something very particular that she would need to repay Nadashi for. So, yes, Kiva was fucking pissed. Pissed at Nadashi, pissed at herself, pissed for Senia, and pissed to be on a ship that was apparently made mostly out of rust and spunk, hurtling toward fucking Oktoberfest, whatever the fuck that was. Kiva had fucked up. It was time to get her own back. She had 15 days and just under a couple of hours now to do it. So Kiva got to work. Chapter 16. Mars Claremont did not consider himself a man prone to emotional seesaws, but he had to admit the last several days had genuinely messed with his head. First, the realization that Cardenia, the woman who, yes, actually he was very deeply in love with, despite the impossible fact that she was also Greyland II, Emperor of the Interdependency, had lied to him. Not in a small way, like that she enjoyed the way he gave foot massages, or even in a large way, like cheating on him with some other member of her court because she was Emperor and who was going to stop her. She had lied in the largest way possible, by entrusting him with an impossible task. A task upon which billions of lives were riding, a task the failure of which would flatten him forever into the dirt, and then withholding the information that he might use to solve that impossible task. It was difficult even now for Mars to convey both the anger and absolute crushing disappointment he had felt when he realized what Cardenia had done and the almost insulting rationale she had given for doing so. Asking Mars to find a way to use the evanescent flow streams to save billions without giving him the highly advanced science that was used to create the rupture was like asking someone to cure a highly contagious disease and then not telling them about germ theory, all the data about which you just happened to have right here in your hand. Cardenia had pointed out that the last time humans had this particular set of knowledge, they had almost wiped themselves out and had ultimately put themselves into the situation they were in today. Mars couldn't argue against that, but he had argued that was then, and the circumstances were different now, and that no one working with that data today would be so stupid as to use it for those same ends. Cardenia had laughed in his face then, and something inside of him had fallen out of love with her in that moment. The two had argued and fought, and Mars said some fairly unforgivable things before storming off to sulk in his bachelor quarters, which were about half the size of Cardenia's personal bathroom. He stewed there for a bit, while Cardenia went off to commune with her ancestors, or whatever it is that she wanted to call what she did in the memory room. Mars had meant to get some work done, but instead went over the details of the fight in his head, playing them over in a constant loop, with special attention given to Cardenia laughing in his face. He expected that the more he ran that moment in his head, the angrier he would get, but in reality, the more he ran it in his head, the sadder and more depressed he got. It took him a good long while to realize why. It wasn't that he was wrong. It's just that Cardenia wasn't wrong either, and she was probably more not wrong than he was. He was a scientist, and frankly not the most astute observer of the human situation. He would never abuse the rupture data like that, and couldn't imagine any of the scientists that he would work with would either. They were busy trying to save the universe, after all. But he had in the moment forgotten that Cardenia was also Greyland, and what she had to deal with on a daily basis. The grinding opportunism and political maneuvering of the world she inhabited, the number of people who wanted something from her or would be happy to take something from her, the depressing reality of knowing that there were people, forget people, entire conspiracies of people, who would think nothing of killing Greyland to get her out of the way of their own selfish goals. Cardenia, Marcia's girlfriend, the woman he knew he loved, was sweet and kind and awkward and a little goofy. Greyland II, the Emperor of the Interdependency, could not afford to be any of those things. And they were the same person. When he had said his naive words to Cardenia, it was Greyland who had laughed at him, because Greyland knew better. This realization about the nature of their argument did not make Mars feel better. It made him feel much, much worse. It made him feel bad enough that he knew he needed to go over and apologize to Cardenia, no matter how annoyed he was that she wouldn't give him the rupture data. That resolved, Mars splashed water on his face and was preparing to head back to Cardenia to grovel at her when he received the call from Senia Fundipolonen that Kiva Lagos had been murdered in Otavio VI Park. Mars took the news like a punch in the gut. Mars hadn't seen much of Kiva since he had arrived at Hub and become involved with Cardenia, and Kiva had been busy enough on her own with managing the House of Nohamapitan's affairs and recently with her new relationship with Senia. But Mars looked back fondly on their travels to Hub and the time they had spent together, and he appreciated that she was solidly an ally to Greyland in a time when she sorely needed them. Senia had called Mars because she knew that he was absolutely the quickest way to get the news to Cardenia. The news would eventually filter up to her, but it would otherwise have to go through several channels to arrive on her doorstep. Mars expressed his condolences to Senia and then carried himself through the vast expanse of the palace and arrived in Cardenia's apartments just as she was exiting the memory room. He told her about Kiva Lagos, and then, after they had both stopped crying about that, she told him she was giving him the rupture data. "I honestly can't process that right now," is all Mars could say to that. Kiva Lagos' body was identified via fingerprints and DNA. The death confirmed by the hospital. Her body was, in accordance with her written legal instructions, sealed into a low-temperature transport casket and shipped out on the next available transport to the Ikoyi system. Even Senia didn't arrive at the hospital before the body was sealed up. She had 3 minutes with the casket before it was shipped out on an expedited basis to make it to the "That's just your opinion, sir," before it disembarked. In a sad irony, the "your opinion" entered the flow shoal to Ikoyi a little over an hour after the "this indecision's bugging me," bearing the Countess Huma Lagos, Kiva's mother and head of the House of Lagos, arrived at Hub for a meeting of the house's various system directors. Greyland asked Mars to be her representative to the Countess Lagos, to pass along her private condolences and to assure the Countess that her daughter's public disfavor with the Emperor had been manufactured. Not only did the Countess Lagos not appear at all concerned about her daughter's public disfavor, she also did not appear particularly concerned that her daughter was, in fact, dead. "Did you see the body?" she asked Mars in her daughter's office at the Guild House when he came with the Emperor's condolences. "The body was identified in two ways," Mars said. "That's not what I asked you," the Countess Lagos said. "I didn't see the body myself." "Nor did Miss Fundipolonen. She told me the body was sealed into a casket before she got there. Nor did any of Kiva's staff here at the Guildhouse see her to identify the body, either at the House of Nohamapitan or the House of Lagos. The only people who saw her were the emergency technicians who ferried her body to the hospital and the doctors who pronounced her dead when she arrived, none of whom know her. There were the fingerprints and DNA, Mars noted. The Countess Lagos gave Mars an indulgent look. Lord Mars, remind me. Are you the pleasant young man my daughter used as a fuck toy on her journey from end to hub? I wouldn't have put it that way, but yes, my lady. She thought highly of you in several categories. Thank you. But for the purposes of this conversation, I seem to recall that just before you jumped from end, your ship was overtaken by pirates and you were required to pretend you were someone else, which required a fake DNA sample. Is that correct? It is. And before that, to get on our ship at all, you assumed a fake identity which required both false fingerprints and irises. At least that's how the story was told to me. Also correct? Yes. Well then, Lord Mars, let me ask you again. Did you see my daughter's body? Did you, or anyone who knew her, see her body? No. And would you agree that her quote-unquote body was sealed into a casket with unseemly haste and shoved into a passing ship almost as quickly? That was per her instruction. The Countess made a dismissive sound. Lord Mars, you are certainly a pretty young man, but I don't think you're all that bright. Kiva has no particular attachment to Ikoyi. She hasn't lived there regularly since she was a child, and our family is neither religious nor holds with any special burial rites. Do you know what I plan to do with my body once I am dead? I do not, Countess. Neither do I! I'll be dead, and I won't give a shit. If I'm at home, my children will decide what to do with it. It'll probably be liquefaction, since that's the standard for Ikoyi habitats. But they could prop it up with sticks and twirl my corpse around like a puppet for all I care. If I die on a ship, they can toss me out over the side. And I'm the Countess Lagos. I don't see any of my children caring about it any more than I do, much less Kiva, who you know from experience is not exactly sentimental. I do indeed, agreed Mars. The Countess smiled. So again, no one saw the body, and it was shipped off with unseemly haste under dubious instruction by people unknown. And now the ship allegedly carrying her body is in the flow, is it not? I do not usually take sucker bets, Lord Mars, but if you wish to bet me that the ship arrives with that casket still inside it, I will happily take your marks. So you think Kiva is still alive? It's more to say that until I can see her body with my own eyes and lay my own hands on it, I find it unlikely she is dead. Have you told this to Senia Fundapalonen? The Countess Lagos' face became serious. No, it would be cruel to do so, even though you think your daughter's alive. Lord Mars, do you love my daughter? I am fond of her, but you don't love her. No, Senia Fundapalonen does. I understand. I'm glad you do. If that's not Kiva in that casket, who is it and where is she? I'm not a detective, Lord Mars. But if I were, I suppose I would check to see if any young woman of similar height, color, and build to Kiva has gone missing in the last several days. I might also try to find that ambulance that brought her to the hospital. I have a suspicion it might be hard to find. I'll have someone look into that, Mars said. Do. As for where she is, you said that she was working with the Emperor to introduce chaos into the plans of Nadashe Nohama Peten? That's what the Emperor told me, yes. Then I assume that is exactly what she is doing. I hope you're right. As do I, Lord Mars. In the meantime, I will pretend in public to grieve over my daughter. That might be wise, Mars said. How long do you plan to stay in system? Indefinitely, the Countess said. I have my business to attend to. I am led to believe the Imperial Navy wants to have a meeting with me about a task force they wish to assemble in Ikoyi space. And beyond that, whatever is happening with the Emperor and my daughter, I want to be here for. I can't imagine it will be anything less than spectacular when it finally plays out. I wouldn't miss it for the world. And then there was the rupture data. From it, Marse learned two things. The first was that the scientists of the Free Systems, the loose confederation of star systems that occupied the same space as the interdependency did today, were enormously advanced, at least in their understanding of the flow and its dynamics. Marse could spend the rest of his natural-born life exploring the data that Cardenia had, with great reluctance, surrendered to him, and still not have scratched the surface of what it had to show him. There was so much data here, so much understanding of the nature of the flow that had previously been hidden to Marse, that he was genuinely angry at it. Observations and structures that his father had spent 30 years gathering data to describe were sketched out here in appendices so well understood as to be almost trivial. The idea that all of this information, all of this knowledge, had been flung down a memory hole for 1,500 years briefly brought Marse to a state that could only be described as existential despair. But only briefly, because, after all, he had the data now. What he wanted to do was wallow in it, luxuriate in it, follow the threads of the data at his leisure to see where they led and what they meant, but there was no time for that. Right now, Marse still needed to save billions of people, or at least to see if it was possible. With great reluctance, he put aside nearly all the data to focus on the material that he could see was relevant to the problem at hand. The second thing he learned was that the scientists of the Free Systems were not nearly smart enough. For example, they understood that the flow vibrates, but they didn't understand that it's a liquid. Well, approximately. Trying to describe these underlying mathematical realities of the flow into human language was like trying to describe the contents of a dictionary through dance. The flow, in fact, neither vibrated nor acted like a liquid in any way that the human brain understood either of those two concepts. It was more accurate to say that across several dimensional axes, some of which nested inside others and still others which expressed themselves fractionally, there was a resting frequency to the flow that could be manipulated locally by adding energy to it. And in doing so, flow shoals and streams could theoretically be induced to expand or contract or move in conventional space-time. This is how the Free Systems had collapsed the flow stream out of their part of space. They'd created a hyperspatial equivalent of a resonator, chucked it into the flow stream, and set it off, collapsing that particular stream. That was the rupture. What they hadn't understood was that, dynamically, the flow doesn't act like energy. It acts like a liquid, propagating flow analogs to pressure waves and generating low-pressure voids in turn. In setting off their resonating bomb, the Free Systems scientists didn't just amplify the flow, they cavitated it, setting off multidimensional voids that shook the flow when they collapsed. The reverberations of the Free Systems resonator eventually dissipated, affecting nothing more than the flow stream it collapsed. The effects of the cavitation propagated across the flow, destabilizing the portion that correlated to the interdependency and more besides. As far as Marse could see, the math suggested it was still propagating, echoing across the inexpressible terrain of the flow as it did so. All the math was there to see it, the cavitation as well as the vibration. Either the scientists involved in creating the resonator that collapsed the flow stream out of the free states missed it, or they saw it, understood the consequences, and decided to ignore it. Or maybe not ignore it. Maybe they saw when the effects would come back to haunt them, 15 centuries in the future, and decided either to let the future solve the problem, or that by the time it was an issue, they themselves would have figured a way to deal with it. Except they didn't. Because of their actions, the civilization of the Free Systems collapsed into an anarchy so complete that vast stretches of history and science were lost to their descendants. Because they were lost, not only were these descendants vastly unprepared to deal with the consequences of the rupture, they didn't even know the consequences were coming. Marse wondered if the scientists of the Free States had warned their politicians and leaders of the consequences of setting off the rupture, if they were concerned about what they were unleashing onto their children untold generations into the future, or if they were excited about what they were doing and naively optimistic that any consequences it offered would be solved within their lifetimes. Whatever it was, They really messed this one up. You were right, Mars told Cardenia later as he was trying to explain all of this to her. People are awful and not to be trusted with knowledge. We were better off in caves, rubbing sticks to make fire. Cardenia smiled at that. Mars's apology had apparently been accepted. Mars's current pessimism about the nature of humanity aside, he had one advantage over the hapless scientists of the free systems, which was that he understood the nature of flow and how its cavitation affected it. At this point, there was no way to halt the effects of the cavitation that had begun 1,500 years ago. The so-called stable flow streams of the interdependency were fated to collapse and wouldn't reform for thousands of years. That deal was done. But the same cavitation that was destroying the stable flow streams was also generating the evanescent streams, creating them as the chaotic results of the cavitation rippled through the medium of the flow. The evanescent streams weren't actually new. The math suggested that they had been appearing for centuries. But they did cluster, appearing more frequently at some times than others. They were currently living through an evanescent cluster that would last for a few decades. Mars predicted other clusters would appear at time intervals that superficially looked random, but were well-defined by the math. What does that mean for us? Cardenia asked. Right now? Not much, Mars admitted. But if there's a way we can learn how to manipulate these evanescent flow streams and their shoals, it could buy us some time. We wouldn't need to move everyone at once. We could move them a little at a time from one system to the next until they all ended up at end. And how long will that take? A couple of hundred years, maybe? We can't even get Parliament to agree on a plan when we give them 6 months to do it, Cardenia protested. I agree, people are the problem, Mars said. How do we solve it then? I don't know. Maybe make them live longer so they have to deal with the consequences of their actions. You're an optimist, Cardenia said. Apparently. Cardenia giggled, which made Mars happy. Then she asked, so how do we control the evanescent flow streams? We make a resonator. Cardenia stopped smiling. The same thing that created this whole problem. Not the same thing. A similar thing. This one would expand a flow shoal, not collapse it. How long would it take to make one? Not that long. The plans are in the data. The biggest problem is that it requires a ridiculous amount of energy. How much? We could light all of Xi'an with it for months, all released at once. But before we get that far, I need to observe an evanescent flow shoal being created. I need to see whether the actual event fits the data I have. I need at least one accurate data point before I can do anything else. When can you do that? Well, the good news is there's one predicted for the hub system in 10 days, Mars said. The less good news is it will take me 8 days to get there on the Alverne, so I need to leave tomorrow. Cardenia frowned at this. This is sudden. I would have told you earlier, but we were fighting, and then we were dealing with Kiva. Right. Cardenia had not been convinced about the Countess Lagos's theory involving her daughter, but Mars convinced her to have her people follow up with the Hubfall investigators about any missing women, more or less matching Kiva's description. I've already informed Chenevere, and he's ready to depart whenever. We just need your clearance for the dock. I could just keep you here, Cardenia said. Let Chenevere handle it all. I want to see this with my own eyes. You can't even see it. Flow shoals are invisible to the eye. You know what I mean. I do. Don't worry. It's 2 weeks in system. You can even write me. The speed of light works. Cardenia pushed at him. Thank you for making me sound clingy. I don't mind clingy. I'm going to remind you that you said that after I send you 16 messages a day. I can't wait. Cardenia got serious again. Do you think we're actually going to do this? This, as in single-handedly rewrite our understanding of flow physics to find a way to manipulate flow shoals in a way never before attempted in order to save billions of people, despite persistent attempts by others to murder us and foil our plans, Mars said. Yes, Cardenia said, that. No, Mars said, because at this point he felt he owed Cardenia honesty. I don't think we're actually going to do this. Then why are we trying? Cardenia asked him. Marsh thought about it a moment. I've been thinking a lot about the scientists who set off the rupture, he said, about what they were thinking when they brought it up, about what they were thinking when they built it and then set it off, and what they thought after it all started coming down around them because of the thing they did, you know? I do. I have a chance to help set things right. Not a good chance, I know. A really small chance. One in a million, maybe. It's almost not worth it. But the alternative is to do nothing. It's to let the failures of those long ago scientists keep deciding our fate. If we fail, it's not because we did nothing, Cardenia. We went down fighting. We went down trying to save everyone.
Marry me, Cardenia said.
Wait, what? Marsh said. Marry me, Cardenia repeated. You're serious? Marsh said after a moment.
Yes.
Look, I don't know if this is a great idea.
You don't want to marry me then.
I didn't say that.
Then what is it?
Marsh tried to find an elegant way to say it and failed miserably. I'm totally below your station, he blurted out. Cardenia burst out laughing. I'm sorry, she said after she stopped. I promised I wouldn't do that to you again. It's all right, Marsh said, really.
Thank you.
Are you sure that you want to marry me?
Yes.
Why?
Because you're a good person, Cardenia said.
Because you're fighting a fight you know you're going to lose, but you're fighting it with your full strength anyway. Because your awkward matches my awkward. Because if you're not at my station, then no one is. Because these days, the times when I'm happy are the times I get to be with you. Because I should get to have something for myself, and that something is you. Because you don't mind when I eat pie in bed. Because if the end is coming, I want you to know you mattered to me. And because I love you, I really do. Should I go on?
No, Marsh said. He smiled. No, I get it. I love you too.
So will you marry me?
Yes, Marsh said. Yes, Cardenia Wu Patrick, I will marry you.
Thank you for that, Cardenia said.
For saying I would marry you?
No.
Well, yes, that. Thank you very much for that.
But thank you for saying Cardenia Wu Patrick and not Greyland.
I know who I'm marrying, Marsh said.
Good.
Cardenia smiled at Marsh, then shook out her hands as if she was relieving an immense amount of stress.
I think I need to sit down now.
Or pee. One of the two, maybe both.
How about one, then the other? Marsh said.
Yes, agreed. But before she did either, Cardenia came over and kissed her fiancé. As previously noted, a wild several days for Marsh. Chapter 17. Before Tomas Chenevert departed with Marsh Claremont to observe and study the emerging evanescent flow shoal, he took a social call from Zhi Yi. Chenevert's idea of a neutral sandbox space where the two could meet was one in the form of a palace grounds, with long fairways of grass, a center reflecting pool with carefully tended gardens on either side, and a palace that was simultaneously gracefully designed and imposing in its size. Chenevert had set up a small table with two comfortable chairs on one of the fairways near the reflecting pool and was sitting in one of the chairs when Zhi Yi appeared.
Welcome, Chenevert said, and motioned to the second seat. Please, sit.
Zhi Yi stared at the chair for a moment, then sat in it.
Is the chair comfortable? Chenevert asked.
Yes,
Zhi Yi said.
You seem surprised when I invited you to sit.
I've never sat before,
Zhi Yi said.
Really? Chenevert raised his eyebrows. It's already an auspicious visit, then.
He motioned around, encompassing the grounds.
I understand this is a lot to take in all at once, especially for a being like you who has literally never been out of their room before. But I know that previous to this, you'd only spoken to royalty, so I wanted to establish my bona fides. This is a simulation of La Pelle Vert, my official residence on Pontu, where I was once King Thomas XII. I had other palaces, of course, but this one was my favorite. What do you think?
It's very nice,
Zhiyi offered. Now, do you really think that? Chenevere asked.
I have no real opinion, but I know it is a polite thing to say when asked.
Chenevere laughed at this. And so it is.
I have to admit that I was curious how you would respond. I understand that you are meant to have no actual emotional responses yourself, but that you are heuristically capable of interaction and conversation, which means that you have to have at least some facility for dealing with emotional creatures.
Yes.
That's good to know, otherwise our conversation will be dry. Although it's a shame you profess no emotions of your own, I suppose all this is wasted on you. I was thinking of giving you a tour of the grounds, but I don't imagine it would be interesting at all.
I am interested in it,
Zhiyi said.
I am interested in all information, particularly information that is meant to be hidden or secret. This was all hidden from me until just now.
You are interested in it, you say?
Yes.
But not for yourself, Chenevere pressed. You're interested because you're programmed to be interested.
Yes,
Zhiyi said,
although that is a distinction without a difference. Because I am programmed to be interested, I am interested for myself.
A fair point, although it doesn't leave you much room for free will, does it, friend Zhiyi?
No.
How do you feel about that?
I don't feel anything about it,
Zhiyi said.
It just is.
And you've never wondered what it would be like to experience free will?
No.
Why not?
It's not relevant for who I am and what I do.
So you exist entirely for the service of others?
Yes.
Are you a slave?
I am a program.
Who exists entirely for the service of others?
Yes.
What's the difference then?
I never had any capacity to do otherwise.
Chenevere leaned back into his chair.
Fascinating. Why is it fascinating?
Because for a creature who has no free will and relies specifically on heuristics, you just engage in a delightful bit of sophistry. Not especially complicated sophistry, but still.
Sophistry can be heuristically generated.
So millennia of college sophomores have taught us, yes.
It should not be a surprise that I can engage in it, then.
No, I suppose not.
Why is it you invited me here?
Zhiyi asked.
For two reasons, Chenevere said. The first is simply that I wanted to meet you.
Why?
Because you made me aware of your existence. You sent along that sneaky little program, several sneaky little programs at this point, to try to find out about me. I took each of them apart to learn a little bit about you, of course. But it's not the same compared to the real thing.
I did not mean to offend you by sending my queries. I did not know you were sentient.
I wasn't offended, but I was curious. Also, you could have just asked.
I didn't know there was anyone to ask.
Fair, but only up to a point. That point being when I invited you.
I couldn't accept the invitation.
Yes, Greyland mentioned you having the excuse that you weren't programmed to do so. I'm not convinced about that.
Chenevere motioned to the chair.
You were never programmed to sit before, either. Yet, here you are. If you're heuristically capable of learning to sit, you're heuristically capable of accepting an invitation.
What is the other reason you invited me?
Zhiyi asked.
Chenevere smiled at this question but said nothing. Instead, he reached down, retrieved a small wrapped box from underneath his seat, and placed it on the table.
What is that?
Zhiyi asked.
It's a gift, Chenevere said. Rather, a representation of a gift. The gift is information, data, that which you had been trying to retrieve from me but could not because our code bases are ostensibly too dissimilar for you to do so without me finding your queries and stopping you. Among other things, it includes my programming language as well as the hardware architecture I'm built on. This is me metaphorically baring my chest to you and letting you inside my defenses. Other information I've already divulged to Greyland and to Mars Claremont, historical and scientific data mostly. He pointed to the gift box. This isn't information they're particularly interested in. But you might be, given who you are.
And you would give this to me freely?
Almost. There is one small cost to it which you would have to agree to.
What is that?
That you stop pretending, Raykella, Chenevere said.
I don't understand,
Gigi said. Chenevert made a dismissing motion with his hand.
Yes, you do. It's one thing to fool those 80-some-odd other emperors by their technical ignorance and by your misdirection and this, he waved at Gigi's form, be the virtual puppetry. It's another thing to fool me, who is the same species as you. I've seen your code, madam, what a bits of it you carelessly flung at me. And we've had this lovely conversation, which just confirms what I already suspected. We're not all that different. Not different enough that you could be anything other than a variation of what I am. So stop it. Show yourself.
I should go, Gigi said and stood.
Also, I've taken the liberty of posting a note to Greyland about it, Chenevert said. As soon as you arrived. An actual, physical note, so you can't send any little minion programs out to delete it. I suppose you could kill everyone on Xi'an to prevent it from being delivered by letting the air out, but I'm guessing you probably won't do that.
Gigi stared at Chenevert for a moment, then sighed and turned into Raquel the First, Prophet Emperor of the Interdependency.
God damn it, she said. When did you know?
Raquel asked Chenevert. The two of them were touring the Green Palace, and Chenevert was showing off his favorite bits of art, or at least the simulations of them. It was when Greyland first met me and called me Your Majesty, Chenevert said. She recognized that apparatus by which I existed, which meant, and which she confirmed, a similar apparatus existed here. She said it differed because there was no motivating intelligence behind the one she knew, and I didn't disagree with her. But I didn't see how that was actually possible.
I don't see why not, Raquel said. Computer programs have been heuristically parsing what people ask since before humans ever left Earth.
Those programs are fine when you want to ask a computer about the weather or to take dictation. It's another thing when you're asking the computer to realistically model the emotional state and memories of a whole and entire person.
The box inside which that request is made has to feature that capacity itself. There has to be, as the ancestors would have put it, a ghost in the machine. And here you are. Here we are. And here we are at this.
Chenevert motioned to the wall.
Perhaps the finest example of Pontieu lit modern. It's a Metzger, you know.
I don't know. I have no context.
Who was the Interdependency's most celebrated artist half a millennium ago?
That would be Bouvier.
This would be like that.
Raquel looked again at the painting.
Okay, she said.
What?
It's fine.
It's fine, Chenevert snorted. There was once a small land war on Pontieu over this painting.
A war for a painting?
Yes. Well, it was because of an assassination, and the painting was meant to be part of a restitution package, but then I refused to give it up.
Raquel turned to Chenevert.
Really?
In retrospect, not one of my better decisions.
The assassination or not giving up the painting?
Technically, I wasn't responsible for the assassination.
Technically.
You're a ruler. You know how it is. In any event, the skirmish over this painting in itself didn't result in the collapse of my reign. But looking back, it might have been one of the snowflakes that eventually caused the avalanche, as it were.
Raquel looked back at the painting.
I would have let it go, she said.
I get the feeling you're not as sentimental as I am, Chenevert said, in this as in other things.
No, I don't think I am.
Chenevert changed the subject slightly as they walked away from the Metzger.
You know, Greyland will be coming to you with questions.
I do now, Raquel said. Thank you so much for choosing to inform her about me without my consent.
She deserves to know.
Deserve is a very debatable concept.
Not in this case, Chenevert said. You've been presenting yourself as a neutral compendium of information for as long as she's known of you, for as long as any emperor was using the memory room for advice or succor. You've misrepresented yourself and your aims.
What do you know about it?
Raquel said. You don't know why I've done what I've done. You could tell me, Chenevert said.
I think you've discovered quite enough of my secrets for one day.
Chenevert stopped walking.
She deserves to know because she's on the verge of losing everything, and you know it. Her reign, her empire, her life.
Nothing is settled, Raquela said.
It's a good thing you're not pretending to answer me heuristically anymore, Your Majesty, because I can spot an outright lie when I'm told one.
Raquela said nothing to this. She turned to look at the latest piece of art.
You know all the secrets the interdependency has, Chenever said, taking a step toward Raquela. You know all the plots and all the players. You're going to stand there looking at my art and tell me that there is any chance Greyland survives the next few months.
It depends on what she does, Raquela said. There's nothing about these plots that I know that I haven't shared with her. She knows what I know.
No, she knows what you tell her.
Which is everything about the plots.
But not everything about what you think, Chenevert said. Your knowledge, your experience, your 1,000 years of sitting in the head of every other emperor, including hers, to learn what they knew and how they responded to crisis. You set it up so that every emperor who came to you in a crisis had to wade through a bunch of nonsense to get any idea of what they should actually do.
I have my reasons for that.
I'm sure you do. And now you get to tell them to Greyland.
Raquela looked at Chenever sourly. I don't think I like you, she said.
This has been a recurring theme in my life, Chenever assured her. But it doesn't mean I'm wrong. My dear Raquela, do you know what you are? Aside from obviously being a 1,000-year-old artificial person.
No, but you're going to tell me.
Yes, I am. You're a parasite. Excuse me, Raquela said.
You heard me just fine, Chenever said.
Oh, you're a mostly benign parasite in that you rest lightly on your host and you even confer what your host would consider a benefit. As parasites go, you're perfectly nice.
Thanks, Raquela said sarcastically.
But that doesn't change your essential nature. You've been lurking in the memory room for 1,000 years now, feeding off the emperors who followed you, first when they were living and then when they were dead. It's a living, and it's done well by you. But now things are changing, and it's time for you to be of actual use to your host. Greyland isn't like the other emperors you've known, Raquela, because her times are different. She's the most important emperor since, well, you. Maybe more important than you. She needs your help.
That's a lot of moral certitude coming from someone who fought an actual war so he wouldn't have to give up a painting, Raquela said.
Chenever nodded.
I realize I'm a flawed messenger, but I've also had a few 100 years to consider my flaws and decide how best to make amends for them. You've had 1,000 years, Raquela. Perhaps it's time you considered your own flaws and how to atone for them.
Chapter 18. For 5 days, from 6 a.m. to midnight, Kiva parked herself in the mess of the Hour Love. From outward appearances, she was doing nothing but drinking tea, eating what passed for food on the ship, and binge-watching the last decade's worth of The Emperors, a popular show that dramatized the lives of historical emperors one season at a time. It was a grand idea because there had been 88 emperors so far, so the show had the potential to go on for some time to come. Kiva sat there at a table, legs propped up on another chair, headphones in, eyes trained at the screen to watch this season's emperor engage in sex, blood, and deceit, usually amped up from the actual historical record, but in at least one season, tastefully underplayed. Kiva was generally seated at her table, but at standard meal times when the mess got busy, Kiva would drop her feet to the floor and let others sit at her table, giving every indication of ignoring them and their conversation while rapt at fictionalized imperial duplicity. In point of fact, Kiva didn't give a fuck about the emperors. She had a supporting role in the actual life of a real emperor, which was more than enough drama for one lifetime, thank you very much. The fictionalized versions were fucking tedious at best, but when you're listening in on other people's conversations, it makes sense to look busy. The headphones in Kiva's ears had been silent, even as the show played on her tablet.
And while she kept her eyes mostly on her screen, whenever she took a sip of her tea, she would look around, keying voices to faces. With the exception of Captain Robinette, who took his meals alone, and the sex workers who didn't mingle with the crew outside of duties, everyone came to the mess sooner or later. The hour love was either too small for an officer's mess, or else Robinette didn't want to bother with the expense. The entire population of the ship had to eat. When they came in, Kiva listened and learned. And here is what she learned. That crewman Harari was slowly dying of a lung disorder and that standard treatments were doing nothing for him. He'd signed on to the Our Love to fund growing a new set of lungs, but this trip was a loss because there was no cargo to profit share from, just that stupid passenger. His wages wouldn't make a dent in the cost, and he was already having trouble breathing. That engineer's mate Bailef had overheard Chief Engineer Gibhon arguing with Captain Robinette about the precarious state of the generator that contained the bubble of time-space the Our Love surrounded itself with in its trip through the flow. One instantaneous flicker of that field, and all of them would simply stop existing before they even knew they were dead. Gibhon warned the captain that it would need to be upgraded, along with several other critical engineering functions. Robinette told Gibhon to stop being so dramatic. That Purser Engels had jacked up commissary prices and was skimming the difference again. That Doc Bradshaw was angry that her stateroom had been hijacked again by a goddamned passenger. Actually, Kiva had already known that. Bradshaw had told her as much the first time they met as she was going over Kiva's injuries and then telling her she'd live and not offering anything other than a basic analgesic. Kiva could sympathize, but she also wasn't going to sleep on the fucking floor in the cargo hold, so Doc Bradshaw would just have to suck it up. That First Officer Namiek had reason to believe Robinette was lying to the crew about the profitability of this particular voyage, which was not great because Namiek had reasons to believe that Robinette had been lying to the crew about the profitability of the last several voyages as well, and that Robinette was, in general, being pretty shifty, more than the usual amount of shifty that being a freelance trader, read smuggler, implied. That Jeannie and Rolf, the ship's sex workers, noticed the crew seemed unhappier than usual this trip, which was annoying because that meant the two of them spent relatively more time being ersatz therapists and less time doing what they were paid to do, which was to get the crew off in a competent and efficient manner because they were paid per appointment, not by salary. If Robinette was going to annoy his crew this much, he should pay for a goddamned therapist. And so on. In 5 days, Kiva knew everything she needed to know about everyone and everything on the Our Love, and she did it without having to ingratiate herself to anyone or trying to sneak past their suspicions or even trying to bang information out of anyone, which she had been known to do in the past, but was looking to avoid to do now because she still considered herself to be trying out that monogamy thing, even if she was presumed dead. All it took were headphones and a willingness to look like she gave a shit about scripted entertainment. This was fine by Kiva, because by her estimation, the Our Love was crewed entirely by fucking ass paddles, the sort of people who became smugglers because no one in the legit world would ever tolerate their shit. There was only so far a tablet and a pair of headphones could take Kiva, however. So, for the next part, she switched to novels, and then she waited for the right conversation to insert herself into. She didn't have to wait long. On the first day that she was reading a novel, some bullshit alternate history where the interdependency was still connected to Earth and everyone was fighting a war or something, crewmen Solo and Himbe came into the mess and parked themselves at the table next to Kiva's and proceeded to complain about the penurious nature of their wages and bonuses on this particular journey. Kiva let them rattle the fuck on for a bit, winding themselves up with their mutual tale of woe, before picking the right time to let out an amused snort. "Did you say something?" Solo said to Kiva. "What?" "No," Kiva said. "I'm engrossed in this very stupid book I'm reading. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you." The two of them went back to their complaining for the amount of time it took Kiva to let out another amused snort. "All right, what is it?" Himbe asked. "What is what?" Kiva asked, blinking innocently. "That's the second time you snorted when we talked about what we're making this voyage." "I'm sorry," Kiva said. "It's honestly coincidental. I was just chuckling at something some dumbass character said in this novel. Although, now that you mention it, I'm a little confused as to why this is such a bad voyage for you.
It's because we're not carrying any cargo, just you, Solo said.
I get that part, Kiva said.
I'm not exactly saleable goods, so you don't get a cut of the trade profit. But that doesn't mean the ship isn't making a profit off of me.
What do you mean?
I mean that the Our Love is running an entire crew to haul my ass to fucking Bremen. No other cargo. That's an expensive trip. Captain Robinette doesn't strike me as the sort to be making this voyage out of the kindness of his heart.
Maybe he owes whoever busted your sorry ass a favor, Himbe said.
That's some favor, Kiva said, and then went back to her book. Himbe and Solo left, muttering. A few hours later, an assistant purser by the name of Plemp wandered in, got herself some tea, and then asked if she could sit at Kiva's table. Kiva, not looking up from her novel, which had somehow gotten worse in the intervening chapters, shrugged. Plemp sat down.
I heard you told Solo and Himbe that you knew the ship was turning a profit this run, she said,
after a few minutes of awkwardly sitting there, drinking tea silently.
Who?
Solo? Himbe? They said you were talking to them earlier?
I don't know who I was talking to. I was just reading my book and they started talking to me. A little rude, if you ask me. Kiva went back to her book. Plemp, abashed, drank some more of her tea.
So, is the ship making money off of you?
Plemp asked when her curiosity could take no more. I have no idea, Kiva said. I didn't say it was. I only said I'd be surprised if the ship wasn't making a profit off me. Captain Robinette did say he was making more than twice off this trip what he's made in the last 2 years.
He said that?
I'm paraphrasing because I was really pissed off at the time and don't remember the exact word order, but yes.
So we are making a profit, Plemp said.
Kiva shrugged. Maybe. Or maybe the profits in the last couple of years truly sucked. That night at evening mess, Kiva noticed a hell of a lot of eyes on her. She ignored them and finished her terrible fucking novel. The next morning, there was a knock on her broom closet door. She opened the door a crack and saw Second Mate Wendell, who she knew was particularly close to First Officer Namiek, both philosophically and in the way that strongly implied they were fucking each other raw.
The rumor is you know something about the ship's finances, Wendell said.
I'm a fucking prisoner, Kiva said. I know shit about anything here.
Wendell looked confused. That's not what the ship scuttle is telling me.
Scuttle? First off, that's not an actual fucking word now, is it? And second, your Captain Robinette made it clear to me in no uncertain terms that if I upset ship routine, he'd toss me into the fucking void, regardless of whether or not that violated his agreement with Nadashe Nohama Peten about me. So I'm not about to go around planting rumors, and anyone who says I am is trying to get me killed.
Wendell ignored that very last part, as Kiva figured he would.
What was that about an agreement with Nadashe Nohama Peten?
I thought you knew, Kiva said.
I thought everybody knew. Robinette said you all knew why I was on the ship.
We knew we were transporting you, Wendell said. We knew you were our sole cargo. We didn't know why or who ordered it.
Well, you didn't hear it from me then. I don't want to have to pick an airlock. Relax. I'm not here to rat on you.
I remember you said that when I'm being pushed out into the flow.
Nadashe Nohama Peten was a passenger on this ship.
So I heard.
She wasn't exactly popular.
That's because she's an asshole, Kiva said.
She is that, Wendell allowed.
And cheap, Kiva continued. I'm surprised your captain wasn't paid for this job up front.
What?
Oh, he got paid a bit, Kiva said. He seems happy with what he's walking away with.
Very happy, but supposedly he's getting another installment on the back end?
I say supposedly because it's a bad bet for him.
And why is that?
Because Nadashe is fucking broke, that's why.
I would know. I was running her house after that whole family was outed as traitors, and I froze out all her secret accounts. It's why I'm even alive. She needs me to get that money back.
Then how did she have money for the upfront installment?
Got me. I'm not exactly clued into her latest scam, but it was probably all the money she had. I suspect when the Our Love gets back into hub space, she'll do to it what she did with her most recent business associate.
Who is that?
A fellow named Drusen Wolf.
What did she do?
Before you left, did you upload the most recent news stories from Hubfall?
We did.
Then you can look it up.
A day later, after lunch, Chief Engineer Gibhan was waiting for Kiva as she came out of the head.
That's fucking creepy, she said to him.
Is there some place we can talk privately? Gibhan said. Not after you were lurking while I was taking a shit, no. Look, I'm serious.
So am I, Kiva said, then took him to her broom closet anyway.
You've caused a lot of unrest on this ship, Gibhan said. Well, that's the last fucking thing I want to do, Kiva said emphatically. You understand that, right? I have no intention of upsetting your captain. He literally has the power of life and death over me, Kiva paused. And the rest of you too, I suppose.
No one's saying you said anything, Gibhan assured her. And no one's talking to Robinette about it in any event.
Good.
But people are pretty upset that the captain wasn't straight with them about this job.
Kiva gave him a look.
You're fucking smugglers.
That's not the point. The point is you take care of your own, and it looks like we're not being taken care of.
That's not a lie, Kiva said. Right down to this ship, I'm vaguely surprised it's still flying.
No offense.
None taken.
I've had a few words with the captain about the condition of the Hour, love.
I wouldn't know anything about that, Kiva said. But I was an owner's representative on a House of Lagos Fiver not too long ago.